Have you ever shouted, "Mine," as a child? That primal claim is one of the first words we learn, and it shapes our lives in ways we rarely notice. But what if everything you know about ownership is wrong? Michael Heller and James Salzman's groundbreaking book, Mine, reveals how the rules of ownership are constantly manipulated by governments, businesses, and individuals to create winners and losers in society. The book has become required reading in law schools nationwide and sparked conversations about property rights from Silicon Valley boardrooms to Capitol Hill. Even Elon Musk reportedly keeps a copy on his nightstand, fascinated by its insights into how ownership shapes power dynamics in modern society. The book's revelations about how ownership works have been called the greatest unknown policy success story of our time by The Economist, offering a new lens through which to view everything from airplane seat conflicts to climate change solutions. The battle for ownership surrounds us daily, from the moment someone reclines their airplane seat into your knees to when you click "I agree" on digital terms of service. These conflicts reveal how ownership isn't a natural state, but a constant negotiation shaped by competing stories, cultural norms, and economic interests. Consider the Knee Defender, a $22 gadget that locks the seat in front of you, preventing reclining. Airlines promptly banned this device, not because they care about your comfort, but because they're selling the same wedge of space twice. They deliberately maintain ambiguity about who owns that space, allowing them to pack in more seats while encouraging passengers to upgrade to roomier options. This strategy extends beyond airlines. Movie theaters, concert venues, and sports stadiums all profit from similar spatial ambiguities, selling overlapping rights to the same space. Similar ownership battles play out in our digital lives, but with even higher stakes. When you browse online, who owns the data trail you leave behind? Though this information feels intimately personal, the ownership remains undefined as tech giants and government agencies race to stake claims. Companies like Facebook and Google have built billion-dollar empires by tracking our digital footprints while we receive nothing in return. Every click, purchase, and interaction becomes a valuable commodity, yet users rarely understand how their data is collected, used, or monetized. Even basic activities like taking photos can trigger complex ownership disputes. When you snap a picture in a public space, you own the copyright, but the subjects may have publicity rights, and platforms where you share it often claim broad usage rights. Even seemingly clear violations of ownership often go unpunished or are deliberately overlooked for strategic reasons. When journalist Jenna Wortham watched HBO's Game of Thrones using login credentials from a guy in New Jersey she'd met once at a restaurant, she was technically committing a federal crime punishable by up to a year in jail. Yet HBO CEO Richard Plepler described password sharing as a terrific marketing vehicle that builds video addicts who eventually become paying customers. This calculated tolerance of theft reveals how ownership rules bend when powerful entities see profit potential. These examples reveal how ownership isn't simply binary, mine or not mine. Instead, it's a sophisticated system of rules that powerful players constantly manipulate to their advantage. Once you understand how ownership is designed, you begin to see these hidden patterns everywhere, from parking spaces to intellectual property, from your genetic data to your retirement savings. The rise of digital assets, NFTs, and virtual property has further complicated traditional notions of ownership, creating new battlegrounds where the rules are still being written. Understanding these dynamics isn't just academic. It affects everything from your personal privacy to your financial security in an increasingly digital world. All ownership conflicts ultimately trace back to six fundamental stories that humans use to claim resources. These competing narratives work because they tap into powerful but conflicting intuitions about what makes something rightfully ours. Understanding these stories helps explain why ownership disputes are often so emotionally charged and difficult to resolve. The first-in-time principle, first come, first served, seems straightforward but is constantly manipulated and reimagined. Duke University rejects this simple approach for basketball tickets, instead requiring graduate students to endure a grueling 36-hour campout weekend where they must respond to random horn blasts day and night just to enter a lottery for tickets. This seemingly bizarre system brilliantly serves Duke's interests by ensuring only the most passionate fans attend games, creating the famous Cameron Crazies atmosphere that enhances their basketball brand. The system also builds community and shared experience among students, strengthening their connection to the university. Disney has similarly transformed the first-in-time principle into a sophisticated profit machine through multiple tiers of access. Their FastPass Plus system taught visitors that sanctioned line cutting exists, but their masterstroke came with private VIP tours, a premium service costing up to $5,000 daily that allows wealthy families to skip every line through discreet side entrances. Disney carefully calibrates this price point to maximize profit without angering regular guests. They've created additional tiers like Genie Plus and Lightning Lane to monetize queue jumping while maintaining the illusion of fairness. This strategic manipulation of first-in-time principles has become a model studied by other entertainment venues and theme parks. Possession, 9/10 of the law, forms another ownership story we learn as children, shaping our fundamental understanding of property rights. This instinct emerges by 18 months of age when mine becomes a crucial vocabulary word, preceding even basic communication skills. The power of possession explains why retailers encourage customers to handle products, knowing that physical connection increases perceived value. When that iPad becomes my iPad, the price suddenly feels more reasonable. Car dealerships leverage this psychology by encouraging test drives, while clothing stores strategically place mirrors near fitting rooms to strengthen the possession effect. The possession principle sometimes overrides legal ownership, as demonstrated in the striking case of Don and Susie Curlin versus their neighbor, former Boulder Mayor Richard McLean. McLean claimed 1/3 of their vacant lots through adverse possession after using the land as his backyard for 2 decades. Though the Curlins had proper deeds and paid taxes on the property, a judge awarded the land to McLean, reflecting the ancient legal principle that a thing which you have enjoyed and used as your own for a long time takes root in your being. This case sparked public outrage and led to changes in Colorado's adverse possession laws, illustrating how deeply rooted possession-based ownership claims remain in both law and human psychology. Similar conflicts arise in digital spaces, where possession becomes more abstract but no less emotionally charged. Social media usernames, domain names, and virtual goods create new battlegrounds for ownership claims based on possession and first-in-time principles, showing how these ancient ownership stories adapt to modern contexts. The labor claim, "You reap what you sow," forms the basis for intellectual property but creates complex tensions in modern society. Martin Luther King Jr.'s "I Have a Dream" speech powerfully illustrates these conflicts. After King's death, his estate aggressively monetized his legacy, charging substantial fees for using his words and likeness, despite King creating his speeches not for profit but to transform civil rights in America. This commercialization extended to everything from educational materials to merchandise, raising questions about balancing public access to historical artifacts with private ownership rights. Even using brief excerpts in documentaries or textbooks required significant licensing fees, leading many educators to avoid teaching certain aspects of civil rights history altogether. The estate's actions sparked debate about whether such tight control serves or undermines King's vision of widespread social change. This ownership approach sometimes creates gridlock, where excessive fragmentation of rights prevents valuable creation. The Emmy-winning documentary Eyes on the Prize, about the civil rights movement, sat unwatched in a vault for 20 years because its creators needed to clear hundreds of separate licenses for footage, photos, and songs. Each rights holder demanded separate negotiations and fees, creating a complex web of permissions that paralyzed the project. Some rights holders couldn't even be located, creating orphan works that remained unusable. It took until 2006 and $1 million in donations to finally make the film available again, demonstrating how intellectual property restrictions can impede cultural preservation and education. Similar challenges have affected other historical documentaries, museum exhibits, and digital archives. Similar gridlock affects life-saving medical research across multiple fields. A pharmaceutical executive described how a promising Alzheimer's treatment was abandoned because numerous biotech firms held patents on different brain pathways the drug affected. Each demanded high fees, collectively exceeding the drug's potential profit. Rather than navigate this patent thicket, companies shifted to less ambitious projects where they already controlled relevant patents. This pattern repeats in cancer research, genetic medicine, and vaccine development, where overlapping patent claims create barriers to innovation. The COVID-19 pandemic highlighted these issues when multiple companies held patents relevant to vaccine development, requiring complex negotiations during a global health crisis. Attachment, My Home is My Castle, extends ownership beyond physical boundaries in ways that constantly shift with new technologies. When William Meredith shot down a drone hovering over his Kentucky property, a local judge dismissed charges against the self-proclaimed #droneslayer, despite video evidence showing the drone was flying above 200 feet. This case highlights how ownership boundaries are being redrawn as technologies like delivery drones challenge traditional property concepts. Similar conflicts have emerged with cell phone towers, satellite signals, and underground resources, forcing courts to reconsider centuries-old property doctrines. The rise of autonomous vehicles, commercial space activity, and augmented reality are further complicating questions of where property rights begin and end. Recent disputes over 5G tower placement, space debris ownership, and virtual reality overlays on private property demonstrate the expanding complexity of these issues. These evolving challenges demonstrate how traditional concepts of ownership struggle to adapt to technological change and digital innovation. From artistic works to medical breakthroughs to airspace rights, society must balance individual property rights against collective benefits while preventing excessive fragmentation from stifling progress. The emergence of artificial intelligence, blockchain technology, and the metaverse is creating new forms of intellectual property that further challenge conventional ownership frameworks. Finding solutions requires reimagining property rights for the digital age while preserving innovation incentives and public access to knowledge. Self-ownership. Our bodies, ourselves, forms the foundation of all ownership claims, yet remains contested in crucial ways. The concept dates back to philosopher John Locke's assertion that we own ourselves and, by extension, the fruits of our labor. This principle underpins modern debates about bodily autonomy and commercial rights to human tissues and organs. Levy Rosenbaum's illegal kidney brokering business exemplifies these tensions, charging up to $160,000 to match dying patients with willing kidney donors. After his arrest in 2009, he became the first person convicted in America for selling living human organs. His defense argued he saved lives by connecting desperate patients with willing donors, while prosecutors maintained he exploited vulnerable people for profit. This case highlights a central dilemma. While donating kidneys is legal and praised, selling them is criminalized worldwide, except in Iran. The prohibition ensures thousands die annually waiting for transplants, approximately 13 people each day in the U.S. alone. Iran, through its regulated organ market, has eliminated its waiting list through compensated donation programs that include medical care, insurance, and monetary compensation for donors. The question remains, which is the greater affront to human dignity, allowing markets in organs or letting people die? America's $80 million a year egg donor market represents another frontier of self-ownership, where women like Wendy Gerrish can sell their eggs for $20,000 each. Premier donors with desirable traits, typically young, attractive, educated women with specific ethnic backgrounds, command premium prices up to $100,000. Fertility clinics maintain detailed databases of donor characteristics, from SAT scores to athletic achievements. This market emerged only after in vitro fertilization became possible in the 1980s, raising questions about which bodily resources should be treated as sacred, priceless, versus profane, marketable. The struggle for self-ownership extends to professional athletes' careers, particularly in baseball's history. Baseball legend Curt Flood challenged the sport's reserve clause in 1969 when he refused a trade to Philadelphia, writing to Commissioner Bowie Kuhn, "I do not feel I am a piece of property to be bought and sold." The reserve clause bound players perpetually to one team unless traded or released. Though Flood lost his Supreme Court case and his career ended, his principled stand inspired other players. His cause eventually succeeded with the 1998 Curt Flood Act, which prohibited owners' total control over baseball players and helped establish modern free agency, fundamentally transforming professional sports labor markets. These cases illustrate the ongoing tension between personal autonomy and social regulation, raising fundamental questions about the limits of self-ownership in a market society. From organ donation to reproductive technology to professional athletics, society continues to grapple where to draw the line between permissible and prohibited forms of bodily commerce. Family ties, "The Meek Shall Inherit," represent the final ownership story, quietly creating vast wealth disparities across generations. The impact is particularly severe in minority communities, where informal inheritance practices have led to devastating losses of generational wealth. When Black Americans die without wills, their land often becomes heir property, fragmenting ownership among multiple heirs with catastrophic consequences for wealth preservation. John Brown's 80-acre Mississippi farm, purchased in 1887 for $575, illustrates this tragedy perfectly. Over several generations, ownership fragmented among 66 heirs after multiple family members died without wills. When his daughter-in-law Ruth sought legal remedy to secure her portion, the court's decision to force an auction sale resulted in a white-owned lumber company acquiring the entire property for far below market value, a pattern repeated countless times across the South. This systematic erosion of Black land ownership has been staggering in scale. Black farm ownership has plummeted 98% since 1920, compared to a 50% decline for white-owned farms. The statistics tell a stark story. 3/4 of Black Americans don't have wills, double the percentage of whites, resulting in over 1/4 of Black-owned land in the Southeast becoming heir property. This fragmented ownership makes basic land management decisions nearly impossible, from securing loans to implementing conservation practices or even selling timber rights. America's founders explicitly rejected England's aristocratic inheritance system, viewing concentrated inherited wealth as fundamentally incompatible with democratic governance. They abolished entailment and specifically forbade titles of nobility in the Constitution, understanding that extreme wealth concentration inevitably corrupts government institutions. However, recent decades have seen this founding principle steadily eroded through tax policy changes. The estate tax exemption has risen dramatically to $23.4 million per couple in 2023, effectively eliminating inheritance taxes for all but the wealthiest 0.1% of Americans and paving the way for a second gilded age of inherited privilege. Trusts have emerged as perhaps the most powerful ownership innovation enabling this new American aristocracy. South Dakota led a race to the bottom among states by abolishing the centuries-old rule against perpetuities that had previously limited trust duration. The state now offers dynasty trusts that can last forever, asset protection trusts that shield wealth from creditors and ex-spouses, and extreme secrecy provisions that rival offshore tax havens. This transformation has been remarkably successful, By 2020, South Dakota trust companies held over $350 billion in assets, surpassing traditional tax havens like Switzerland and the Cayman Islands. These trust structures allow America's wealthiest families to create perpetual private dynasties while avoiding taxes and public scrutiny, precisely the outcome the founders sought to prevent. Ownership isn't just about conflicts over airplane seats or inheritance. It may hold the key to solving our greatest global challenges. This concept extends far beyond personal property into realms of environmental conservation, resource management, and digital rights. New York City's exceptional drinking water system provides a compelling example of innovative ownership design. The water travels 125 miles from the Catskill Mountains through an intricate system that serves 9 million residents daily. When pollution threatened this pristine water supply in the 1990s, Commissioner Al Appleton reframed the problem using the ownership toolkit. Rather than building a $4 billion treatment plant, he negotiated with upstate communities to restore the watershed's natural filtering capacity, creating a payment system that compensated landowners for maintaining water quality. This as-if ownership approach, treating environmental services as owned assets, has spread globally with over 550 programs worth $42 billion annually, from Costa Rica's rainforest preservation to China's ecosystem services payments. The transformation of Alaska's crab fishing industry demonstrates how ownership structures can save lives and improve efficiency. For years, Alaska's catch limit system inadvertently created a dangerous derby fishing free-for-all where boats competed in treacherous conditions to catch as many crabs as possible before the season abruptly closed, resulting in multiple deaths annually. The solution came from Iceland's catch share system, where fishermen own a specific portion of the total allowable catch before the season begins. After Alaska adopted this system in 2005, the season lengthened from 3 days to 3 months, profits increased fourfold, and deaths plummeted to zero. This approach has since been adopted by fisheries worldwide, proving that well-designed ownership systems can align economic and conservation interests. Cap-and-trade systems have similarly revolutionized pollution control by creating a business opportunity for polluters. Under this system, power plants receive allowances for emissions, but if they reduce pollution below their limit, they can sell excess allowances to other facilities. The U.S. sulfur dioxide trading program reduced acid rain by 80% at one-fourth the predicted cost. The European Union's emissions trading system, despite initial challenges, now covers 45% of EU greenhouse gas emissions, demonstrating how ownership-based solutions can address global challenges efficiently. In the digital world, ownership has become increasingly complex and restrictive. When we click Buy Now online, what we're actually purchasing is a non-exclusive, non-transferable, non-sub-licensable, limited license with severe restrictions on use, transfer, and resale. Companies like Amazon, Apple, and Google maintain strings attached to even these limited rights, allowing them to revoke access without compensation. For example, Amazon has remotely deleted purchased books from Kindles, and Apple can disable entire libraries of purchased content. This widening gap between perceived and actual ownership creates two significant costs: concentration of ownership in a few tech companies and loss of freedom to use our possessions without permission. The sharing economy represents the flip side of digital ownership. Instead of wrongly believing we own more than we do, we intentionally choose to own less through temporary access to others' goods and services. While platforms like Airbnb and Uber have unlocked enormous value from underutilized assets, this shift comes with hidden costs. The sharing economy doesn't build wealth, it consumes it. People lose the discipline of saving for purchases and building equity, particularly through homeownership, historically America's greatest wealth-building tool. Studies show that the median net worth of homeowners is 80 times larger than renters, highlighting the potential downside of the access over ownership model. A common thread runs through mine. We're surrounded by valuable stuff, yet we don't just snatch what we want, and others don't just take from us. Shared understandings of ownership allow strangers to live peaceably alongside each other, with judges deciding perhaps one in a million ownership conflicts while we work out the rest ourselves. This remarkable social cooperation extends from simple interactions like respecting personal space on public transit to complex property arrangements in business deals. The toddler's rules of ownership humorously illustrate our innate understanding of possession. If I like it, it's mine. If it's in my hand, it's mine. If I saw it first, it's mine. And if I had it yesterday, it's mine. These rules ring true because from a young age, children have a strong drive to possess and a surprisingly clear sense of ownership boundaries. Like toddlers, adults are experts at negotiating the spaces between ownership rules, instinctively understanding complex concepts like temporary possession, shared ownership, and fair use without formal legal training. When valuable resources emerge, ownership is always contested, whether it's parking spots in crowded cities, water rights in drought-stricken regions, or digital content in the internet age. The six simple stories everyone uses to claim everything frame these disputes. First come, first served, like camping out for concert tickets. Possession, holding the TV remote. Labor, creating artwork. Attachment, customizing your smartphone. Self-ownership, control over your personal data. And family, inheritance rights. However, there's always a counter-narrative threatening to flip ownership upside down. For instance, while first come, first served might seem fair for concert tickets, it can perpetuate inequality when applied to natural resources or education opportunities. This tension is where things get interesting, as owners constantly tweak ownership rules to steer our behavior. Companies manipulate attachment stories to create brand loyalty. Governments use labor stories to justify property rights, and communities invoke first possession rules to protect shared resources. Understanding these dynamics reveals how ownership shapes everything from environmental conservation to technological innovation. The key lesson is that mine reflects a choice among competing stories, not an absolute truth. Now that we can recognize these hidden rules, we can more effectively advocate for ourselves, our communities, and the common good by asking, whose hand is on the remote control? Who gets what and why? Is first possession the best rule for allocating scarce medical resources? Should labor determine ownership in the digital age? The answers to these questions will determine not just who owns what, but what kind of society we create together, from how we manage climate change to how we structure the digital economy.